So we have the opportunity of having Ron Nikaido with us. We're sorry that his wife Marilyn couldn't be with us this evening, but we're glad that Ron is with us, and may we have hearts that are in tune with what the Lord would have us hear as Ron ministers to us this evening. God bless you.
Well, it's wonderful to be with you this evening. Actually, I came very close to not being with you this evening. In 1907, my grandfather came from Japan to Canada to work on the CPR Railroad as part of the crew that maintained the tracks. And one evening, an avalanche came down and crushed the sleeping car that the men were in and completely buried everybody. And my grandfather was the last man pulled out. And so I came that close to not being with you here this evening. But I do count it a joy to be with you. I currently live in the city of Colorado Springs. I actually grew up in the Toronto area, was born in Toronto and grew up here. But a year ago, I moved to Colorado Springs. Just outside the city is both Peterson Air Force Base and Fort Carson, which is an Army base. And of course, with the buildup in the Middle East right now, we're seeing a lot of activity at both places. Well, at Fort Carson, there's a black Army officer. He's a very religious man. He attends the non-denominational chapel out at the base, wants to worship God and to serve Him. Unfortunately, this Army officer does not know Jesus Christ as his personal Savior, but he's very faithful and diligent in the way that he attends chapel and seeks to worship God to the best of his knowledge. Now, just outside of Fort Carson is a large and growing Southern Baptist church. The pastor of this church has just recently moved from the Deep South. He's a very gifted evangelist, and as he shares the gospel from week to week, he is seeing many, many come to the Lord, and his church is flourishing. And as this Army officer looks at this tiny chapel out at the base, and it struggles from week to week in terms of the proclamation of the Bible and the services, the Christian services that take place there. And he looks out at the Southern Baptist church, and he sees it growing and flourishing, and people are excited, and he wonders, why is there that difference? Well, one day this Army officer sent three black soldiers to the pastor's home to ask him to come out to the base and explain to him why this difference exists between the two. Now, that morning, as the pastor opened the door and saw these three black officers on his front porch, he was confronted with a dilemma. The dilemma for him was that he had never been in the home of a black person before, and he had never had a black person in his home. Now, this pastor loves the Lord. He's very sincere in his desire to follow Him. But every fiber in his being rebels against that thought. Now, what should this man do? What should this pastor do when he's confronted with this situation? Every fiber of his cultural background is churning at that moment. Well, I think we would all agree that this pastor needs to invite these officers into his home, needs to get to know them, and then go out to the base and chat with this Army officer and explain what that difference is. Now, if you were confronted or if you were aware of the situation, what would you do to help this pastor get over this cultural hurdle to welcome someone that, from his cultural background, it's very difficult for him to do? Just think for a moment of how you might prepare this pastor and what you might do to help him do what we all agree he should do. Well, you know, God was faced with a similar situation. And I'd like you to turn with me to Acts chapter 10, and let's look at how God dealt with a very similar situation. I'd like to pick up the account actually in verse 1 of Acts chapter 10. Our account begins at verse 1. At Caesarea, there was a man named Cornelius, a centurion in what was known as the Italian regiment. He and all his family were devout and God-fearing. He gave generously to those in need and prayed to God regularly. One day, at about 3 in the afternoon, he had a vision. He distinctly saw an angel of God who came to him and said, "Cornelius." Cornelius stared at him in fear. "What is it, Lord?" he asked. The angel answered, "Your prayers and gifts to the poor have come up as a memorial offering before God. Now send men to Joppa to bring back a man named Simon, who is called Peter. He is staying with Simon the tanner, whose house is by the sea." Now the two individuals in this account in Acts chapter 10 are a soldier, Cornelius, a Gentile. The scriptures tell us he was devout and one who sought sincerely to follow God. The other is Simon Peter, the apostle, the one who played a very prominent role in the church after the resurrection of Christ. Now, as this account unfolds, we'll see that Simon is a person who has not associated with Gentiles. And so God needs to bring Cornelius and Simon together. Now, Simon is the pastor who has a great cultural barrier that he needs to overcome in order to welcome Cornelius into his home. Now, let's see how God deals with him. Let's jump down one paragraph to verse 9. About noon the following day, as they were on their journey and approaching the city, Peter went up on the roof to pray. He became hungry and wanted something to eat. And while the meal was being prepared, he fell into a trance. He saw heaven opened and something like a large sheet being let down to earth by its four corners. It contained all kinds of four-footed animals, as well as reptiles of the earth and birds of the air. Then a voice told him, "Get up, Peter, kill and eat." "Surely not, Lord," Peter replied. "I have never eaten anything impure or unclean." The voice spoke to him a second time, "Do not call anything impure that God has made clean." This happened three times, and immediately the sheet was taken back to heaven. Now, to appreciate what Peter was experiencing here, we need to think of the most vile creature that you can, the animal or reptile that's most repulsive to you. Maybe it's a snake or a lizard, or maybe it's an insect like a cockroach or a spider. But just picture an animal that's absolutely repugnant to you. And these are the kinds of things that were on this sheet that God lifted down before Peter. And as Peter stepped back in horror and revulsion at the thought of God saying, "Peter, eat, kill and eat." Probably for Peter, it might have been a pig. And you can imagine a Jew, just the thought of eating a swine would be terribly repulsive to him. Now that's what God was presenting before him, to do something that was utterly repugnant to him. Now, how is Peter going to respond to God with this command that's been set before him? Well, let's see what Peter does. Well, Peter was wondering about the meaning of the vision. And wouldn't we do that if we saw something like this? Wouldn't we ponder the meaning of that vision? A strange thing for God to say to Simon, to do something so utterly revulsing to him. The men sent by Cornelius found out where Simon's house was and stopped at the gate. They called out, asking if Simon, who was known as Peter, was staying there. While Peter was still thinking about the vision, the Spirit said to him, "Simon, three men are looking for you. So get up and go down. Do not hesitate to go with them, for I have sent them." Now, not only did God give him this vision of the sheep and the animals and the command to eat, but he also gave Peter a very unmistakable command: go with these men who are now knocking at the gate. That is unmistakable. Peter could not misunderstand that. Peter went down and said to the men, "I'm the one you're looking for. Why have you come?" Now let's just skip down halfway through the next paragraph. The men explain, "A holy angel told Cornelius to have you come to his house so that he could hear what you have to say." Now Cornelius had seen this vision, and God, realizing that he needed not only to be a sincere religious person, but he needed to have saving faith in Jesus Christ. And so God has engineered an encounter that could bring this message if Simon were willing to go. Now it's interesting to note that God, or this angel, could have just proclaimed the gospel to Cornelius. Wouldn't that have been simpler than to try to engineer a meeting between people of two different cultures, the Jews especially, who hated the Gentiles and did not associate with them? Wouldn't it have been simpler just to have the angel share the gospel? But no, God intends that people bring the message of the gospel. And that's one of the lessons, that God has gone through all this effort to ensure that a man, Peter, bring this message. But Peter has this cultural barrier that he needs to overcome. Well, let's jump down to verse 27. Actually, verse 28. Peter says to them, "You are well aware that it is against our law for a Jew to associate with a Gentile or visit him." Now, isn't that incredible for an apostle to say? This man who had walked with Jesus for 3 years, he was there when Jesus spoke to the Samaritan woman at the well, and they had spent 3 or 4 days with the Samaritans after this woman came to faith and many of the villagers came to faith. But Peter was so entrenched in his Jewish culture that he missed the lesson of that encounter with the Samaritan woman. And so here, after the resurrection of Christ, he is still living as a cultural Jew, a person who does not associate with Gentiles. Now he goes on to say, "But God has shown me that I should not call any man impure or unclean." And so the message has gotten through to him that although culturally he has had one view, but he's willing to change that view for the sake of obedience to God. Now let's jump down to verse 34. He says, "I now realize how true it is that God does not show favoritism, but accepts men from every nation who fear him and do what is right." And so that was the conclusion that Peter came to, that God is not a God who shows favoritism. That is, that the Jews are not the only recipients of the gospel, that the gospel is for all peoples, that the gospel is for Gentiles as well. Now that was a tremendous shift for Simon Peter to make. And I think we would find it difficult to appreciate the degree to which Peter shifted in his cultural understanding. Now what's the application of that? Well, I think there are at least two. I'm sure there are more. For us who are sitting here and for whom God has entrusted the gospel message, we live in neighborhoods where there are people who have not heard the message of Jesus Christ. It's interesting that these Romans lived right in the midst of the Jews. The Jews had the message, the Romans didn't. And the Jews were unwilling to share the gospel with these Gentiles who were in their very midst. Well, we all live in neighborhoods where there are people who need to hear the gospel. We work in offices, where all around us there are people who need to hear the gospel. But for us, it can mean a cultural, we need to cross a cultural gap often to bring the message to these people. I think of some of the people in my neighborhood, their lifestyles are totally different from mine. Their moral standards are totally different. Their entire way of life is different from mine. But I need to go to them with the gospel. I need to be willing to enter their world, to cross that cultural gap, to leave the comfort of my Christian upbringing and my cultural, everything that I am as a Christian. And I need to go to my neighbors and those around me with the message of the gospel. Well, there's another application that has a broader implication, and that has to do with this whole matter of missions today. And as we seek to share the gospel in other lands, we are faced with the same cultural gap that we need to cross. As we bring the gospel from the West to many of these emerging nations, we too need to make these cultural transitions in order to be able to share the gospel. And I'd like to share a few things that God is doing in some of these places that are very difficult to reach with the gospel. I'd like to share with you just some things that we're involved in bringing the gospel to unreached peoples. The challenge that we face as Christians, the Christian church, the worldwide Church of Christ, is that 4 out of 5 non-Christians live in this shaded area. And you need to step back a bit. This area that stretches from North Africa right across the Middle East into South Asia and East Asia consists of countries that we call the restricted bloc. And what we mean by that is that it is very difficult or impossible for traditional missionaries to get into these parts of the world. Let's see, I'll try to get out of the way of the screen for you. And so as we think about, as Christians, trying to bring the gospel to the world, we need to think about that shaded area where most of the world's non-Christians live. Now obviously, because it's so difficult for traditional missionaries to get into those places, only 1 in 5 missionaries who are out in the field today serves in that shaded area. And so as we think about the challenge of bringing the gospel there, it's very difficult for a traditional missionary to get into those places. And so what I'd like to do is to share some of the things that we're doing to try to get missionaries in there so that we can share the gospel. One of the first things we do is conduct what we call a field research trip. And this spring, I took 3 businessmen with me to the Soviet Union. And our purpose in going was to attempt to identify the needs that exist in the Central Asian republics of the Soviet Union. And then the goal is for us to try to determine what those needs are, and then to see how Christians can come and meet those needs. Now, I went to a part of the Soviet Union that is in this part of the Great Empire, east of the Caspian Sea. I need about 4 hands here. Try to get this done. You'll probably recognize Turkey, which is south of the Black Sea. And then Iran borders on this part of the Soviet Union. And Afghanistan down in here. And then China bordering the Soviet Union on the east. And so I went to three republics: Kazakhstan, which is the second largest republic in the Soviet Union, Uzbekistan down in here, and Kyrgyzstan down there. And in going there, we're trying to determine what those needs are. And so the goal is to figure out what they need, and then to figure out how we can get Christians there to meet those needs. A few slides here. The part of the Soviet Union that I went into is it's Islamic. The European part of the Soviet Union has a very strong Christian heritage. The church has been in the European part of the Soviet Union for 1,000 years, but the Asian part is very strongly Islamic. These are the city of Moscow has just a number of churches. It surprised me how many churches. I guess my preconceived notion of the Soviet Union was that it was an atheistic society, and yet to go to Moscow and to see so many churches there surprised me. In Central Asia, the architecture changes dramatically, and it's a much more Islamic influence. Very ornate buildings. Now, when we went to the first republic, the capital, Frunze, we met with the trade officials, government trade officials. There were 11 of us who were representing various business interests from the West, and our goal was to get to know them as friends first, and then to identify what needs they have. One of the things that we did was to bring 11 wheelchairs to the disabled children at the Lenin's Hospital in Frunze. And at the time that we put this together, we didn't realize the importance of doing this. The Soviets find it very, well, their economy just doesn't produce wheelchairs, and so disabled children are basically confined to home. Their parents need to just carry them places. And so when we brought the wheelchairs, they were touched by the desire that we had to help their children. And what they did was they had a public presentation ceremony where we brought the wheelchairs and they brought the children who were going to receive the wheelchairs. It was covered by Soviet TV, and government official who was hosting us began the presentation ceremony by saying, "Our impression of Westerners has been that they are cutthroat capitalists who are willing to step on anyone in order to earn a profit. And yet we have these 11 businessmen from the West who have brought wheelchairs to our children at the Lenin's Hospital." And so we each wheeled our chairs over, and we placed a child into the chair. This boy, his name is Nikolai. His father had passed away earlier this year,
his mother gave a very emotional thank you speech to us. This was probably the highlight or the most moving part of my 17-day stay in the Soviet Union. And basically she said, thank you so much for bringing a wheelchair for my son. I will never forget your kindness to our family. And on July 4th, she sent me a telex saying, thank you once again for the gift of a wheelchair. I will never forget you. The lesson that we learned from this is that something as basic and as simple as bringing a wheelchair for a child opens up the hearts of people in a dramatic way. And the heart tie that was created is one such that we could go back any time and do anything else for these people, and they would welcome the help that we would bring. And of course, we have something greater that we want to bring, beyond something greater than just wheelchairs. We want to bring the message of Jesus Christ and a relationship with Him that will change not only, the wheelchairs will help them physically, but the person of Jesus Christ can help every aspect of their lives. This is a doll that they gave me as a small token of their great appreciation for the gift. Afterwards, the children, or some of the other children, gave a cultural demonstration. And an interesting process that's taking place in Central Asia is that when the Soviets took over the Russian Empire after 1917, they attempted to Russianize the empire. They moved Russians in, they forced the people in Asia to learn the Russian language, and they attempted to suppress their culture and their language. Well, now under Glasnost, these people in Central Asia are now able to rediscover their roots. And so they're beginning to teach their young people their language and their culture and some of their music. And so these are some of the things that these young people are involved in order to understand who they are and where they've come from. And you can see how Asian these young people look. Now, certainly they weren't at all like the stereotype image I had of what a Soviet citizen would look like. The opportunity that it poses for us is that as they're trying to identify who they are, we have a tremendous opportunity to bring the gospel in so that they would consider Jesus Christ as part of their cultural identity. This is a group of Christians that we met in Tashkent. This woman in the front here is an architect and one of the key leaders in the church. This man is the president of a children's foundation that the church has put together. One of the tragedies of the current Glasnost situation, these are, Ukrainian believers. And as Gorbachev has made it possible for people now to return to their homelands, these Christians are going back into Eastern Europe, and many of them are trying to make their way to America. And so the night that we visited their church, they were showing the Jesus film as an outreach to the Uzbeks. And they are very active in trying to reach the Muslims with the gospel. But now these Christians are leaving by droves. And so the witness that has been, the only witness that's been there is now declining. And many of the churches are reduced in attendance and membership because these Christians are making their way to the West. And so one of the tragedies of the opening of Eastern Europe is the mass exodus of believers from Central Asia. This is this part of the Soviet Union is very picturesque. It's mountainous. The rural life, it's still based on herding cattle and goats. We got to go to a remote village that foreigners generally don't get to see. And because we met these believers, they took us up into the mountains just to see the poverty that exists in the Soviet Union today. This village was consisted of mud and rock roads. You can't really discern the steepness of this road, but this village was built on the side of a mountain slope. And it was very difficult getting around in this village, especially with the condition of the roads. This is how the Asians dress. It's a Muslim custom for women to be covered, although they're not veiled the way they are in the Middle East. But again, you see the very Asian and mixed national backgrounds that these people have. This is one of the homes. They were very hospitable in showing us through their homes. Of course, we were a curiosity to them, being Westerners in this very tiny village that probably rarely gets visitors. They eat off these low tables, which is, again, a very Eastern style. The staple is bread, which is heaped in the middle of that table. And I thought there'd be more rice, but bread is their staple. But boy, they were just a beautiful people that we'd love to see come to the Lord. Well, these are all Muslims, and we want to. Our desire is to bring the gospel to them. Now that's my family. These are not Soviets. I have a 9-year-old son, and that's my wife, Marilyn. If I could have the lights again. Well, the thing that we've discovered, or the opportunity that we've identified in the Soviet Union, is the Soviets are very interested in having us, or having help with any area of business. I don't think we appreciate how backward they are in terms of this whole area of foreign trade, manufacturing, marketing, all these things. They're in kindergarten when it comes to that. And so in Alma-Ata, which is the capital of Kazakhstan, the second largest republic of the Soviet Union, the Soviets have agreed to provide all the facilities for a school, a business institute. And they're willing to provide housing, transportation, food, and a salary for any teacher that we would bring to this institute. And so we have now put together kind of a joint venture that involves three mission organizations and a university in Pennsylvania that will put together a business institute in Alma-Ata. The Soviets will cover all the costs, and all we need to do is provide the people. And so in a day, the significance of this is that in a day when it's very expensive to get missionaries overseas, this is an opportunity where the Soviets are willing to cover all the costs for us to bring people in to help them in an area of need that they have. And then our goal, obviously, is to be able to share our relationship with Jesus Christ in the context of that. Another of the men that was with us has put together an agreement where this businessman is going to provide a trade office in Atlanta, Georgia, in return for a trade office for Americans in Moscow and in Alma-Ata. And so we have the opportunity of placing four couples, again, in the Soviet Union, where they would, again, meet all the costs of having those people stay. And then in the context of those four couples meeting genuine needs in that society, they will also be able to share their relationship with Jesus Christ. Now, that's just one small example of the approach that we're taking to bring the gospel to these hard hard to reach areas. And so we're involved in the Middle East, in many of the countries of Asia, where we're taking a similar approach. And what I'd like to ask you folks to do is to help us reach the unreached. And you might ask, well, what could you do to reach these people when you're here and they're way over there? Well, one very practical and powerful way is to pray. And what I'd like to ask you to consider would be to pray for these opportunities. Their needs become our opportunities for presenting the gospel. And I have some cards if you'd like to keep updated on in terms of what we're planning to do in some of these places. I'd more than be happy to keep you informed and invite you to pray with us. Thank you very much for this opportunity to share this with you.